Mahalia, welcome to the Center for Indigenous Midwifery's podcast. Our mission is strengthening community by honoring, supporting, and reclaiming Indigenous midwifery care and culturally centered family support. For more information on our programming, visit indigenous-midwifery.org, find us on social media, or tune in for a live Zoom cast offered each month. Thank you so much for listening.
So, Klahalya, Sasai Sisquatch, Rondali Gratham, and I'm here from the Center for Indigenous Midwifery. We have had multiple birthkeeper gatherings, and I've been a midwife for a really long time. And in these birthkeeper gatherings, I've been able to just meet these truly amazing people who have so much to share to help guide us as families are working to reclaim birth and find their power and connect with healers and remember a lot of the old ways and do a lot of healing. And so in those times of meeting these amazing people, and then I would go back home to my midwifery practice and still feel like I couldn't just refer a video for someone to watch as they were preparing on, you know, for their journey. But so many of the childbirth education materials and educational materials in all the way just were not, they're not our stories. And so this podcast is for and by and for in every way intended to be for Indigenous families and for Indigenous birthkeepers to learn and to share from one another, and for families to be able to take in whatever serves them. And so the idea is that we could have several different guest speakers each episode, as well as a time for an Ask the Aunties, where people can put in the chat box some questions that they would like to know or a direction they'd like to go with the speakers. And that each of these episodes will be captured and recorded, and that then people could refer back and be like, oh, I really want, you know, to review this breastfeeding thing, or oh, I missed that time, and I would really love to just talk about the first words I want my baby to hear, or, you know, the first, you know, some songs to sing your baby, just all of those different kinds of topics. And since I made this announcement, you know, so many people have come forward and said, I want to share my story. You know, I was hungry for this when I was pregnant, or I'm pregnant right now, and I really am just trying to find a way to birth and to find stories that speak to me and my culture and my ways and my traditions. So as far as the rhythm for today, we're going to hear from Patricia for the first hour, and then we'll hear from Cami for a bit of time, and then we'll have the question and answer. So if you do have a question that you would like to ask either of the speakers, feel free to put that in the chat box at any time. And then I will bring those back out as time goes on. So I want to, you know, thank so much, you know, to the two presenters today who I love and treasure. And Patricia is as one of my teachers and my elders who I adore and you have so much to offer. And so with that, I'm just going to mute myself and enjoy all that you have to share today.
Thank you.
And if you'd like to introduce yourself, there is a full bio on each of them on the website, but I'd love to just have you introduce a bit about yourself as well.
So everyone, thank you so much. I am a baby catcher and a mother maker. And my great-grandma was a midwife in Texas in the 1800s and into the 1900s. And my great-grandpa and my great-grandma and my great-aunts and my parent, grandpa and grandmas on both sides, they all doctored, and I carried that lineage from my great-grandpa. And I've studied with Nahua midwives. My family is Kickapoo and Comanche. We went into Old Mexico in the 1800s, and some of my family intermarried with the Nahua and the Chichimeca peoples in Zacatecas and Guanajuato, and then some of my family, it was in Texas before it became a republic, and so are the original peoples of what before was Mexico also. So I started to study, well, it's that my first birth, I think, was in part, I helped with is in 1991. And have continued to apprentice with a Nahua midwife ever since then. And really determined that I wasn't going to go, I had just decided that I would stay a baby catcher and not go into the licensing process. And that's a whole nother story. So as I was studying, my ex-husband was admitted into graduate school, and I was given the opportunity to get my master's and then eventually my PhD. And so that's what led me to really think about the more than 20 years of teachings that I had from the Nahua elders, and then my family, some of the things that my family taught me, and that became the work on red medicine. And with the permission of the Nahua elders, who felt that it was important to share things. This was from 1992, when we were all thinking about the consequences of 500 years. We were given instructions to have knowledge that was useful. And so my instructions were to work with birth and with plants. And so as I talked to the elders about what I had lived with them for the last, since 1990, I guess, with the Nahua elders, they gave me permission to systematize and show how our knowledge prevailed and has prevailed. And so that became then the book Red Medicine. Along that way, I started to have teachings around birth as a ceremony. And I remember that there was a traditional Apache Mexica ceremonial leader who was a good friend of mine. She was my neighbor, and she was the one that said, well, birth is a ceremony, being pregnant is a ceremony. And I was still in the early stages of apprenticing as a midwife, and I remember thinking that that totally changed my perspective, that it just hadn't been explicitly stated. And so then I started to really ask the elders, what does it mean that birth is a ceremony? No one at that point, except for maybe for Gudgee, was really talking about birth as a ceremony in a public way. And I think that now we hear that a lot, but at the time, 20 years ago even, it wasn't something that people talked about that openly. That was just the preface, but what I want to talk about is, and there were many things that, you know, that we can look at as that points to how birth is a ceremony. So I'm going to show you some of the images that are in Red Medicine. They're in the original edition of Red Medicine, because the newer editions don't have the red, being the color templates, but the early editions do. But when we think about, there's many ways to think about how birth is a ceremony, but it really returns to our original instructions, and to think about that come from life itself, that come from our relationship with the four elements. And we are comprised of these four elements. And when we are born, we are constituted from fire or light, water, earth, and wind. And when we go back into spirit, our fire returns to the fire, our light returns to the light, our water returns to the water, our body returns to the earth, and our breath returns to the air and the wind. And so when we think about trying to understand those original relationships right there, that is the beginning of understanding how birth is a ceremony. But there's many layers to it based on what our teachings tell us. And I've seen such an explosion, such a widespread desire to return to those teachings that were taken from us, many of our indigenous peoples. But in Mexico, it was very vibrant. And in Texas, where I grew up, a home birth midwife, or depending on how they were classified, was never outlawed. Many, many people that I know were birthed by midwives. But also we had that pressure that we lost a lot of our traditional midwives when the professional midwives sought accreditation. And a lot of the granny midwives just didn't want to participate in those systems. Maybe they didn't speak English, maybe they didn't read and write, maybe they didn't want to be part of the system. And so we lost hundreds of midwives at that time in the 70s in the late 70s when some of the basically non-native, the white midwives were seeking credentials and to have a more solid legal footing in catching babies. But as so, but to go back to the four elements. So I'm going to show you some images, and I was going to go back and forth, but it might be easier if I stick with the images and then come back and talk to you. But I'm going to tell some stories around these images. We had thousands of books in what we call Mesoamerica or Old Mexico, what we call today Mexico and Central America. And they were actually, most of them were destroyed in a bonfire, bonfires when the priest didn't understand our teachings and tried to eradicate our spiritual systems. But a few survived, and there's about maybe 20. There's been, say, it ranges from 16 to 20 that exist. There's been a few more found out of thousands. And a lot of them, the ones that exist, some of them were like cosmological almanacs. And so this one actually shows us the birth powers. And so understanding from a Nahua perspective, and I'm going to speak from a Nahua perspective because that's how I've been trained, and the medicine I carry from my great grandpa is a Nahua medicine. So I have permission also to talk about these things because the elder said that it's important for people to have knowledge to survive. And that was even before, you know, now this global pandemic. So this is from 1992, and the elders talking about the concern of people being able to survive. And so one of the elders, I remember him telling me when I asked him, well, how is birth a ceremony? You know, would ask them this question. And he'd say, well, he talked about a lot of things, but one of the first things he said was that, you know, when we're pregnant, we have the sacred center, and it's from our belly buttons, from the mother's belly button to the stars, there is a sacred cord that connects babies to the creation. And it's not just that the cord and the amniotic fluid is feeding the baby, but there is this other dimension to that cord that connects to the sky. And that is what is the true first nutrient of the baby. And so with birth, we have a lot of first or original medicine. And the first is the first water, which is the water in the womb. And the first light is the light that comes from this umbilical cord to the sky, to the stars, to the sun, depending on the teachings. But this shows a birth power that is present when the cord is cut. There are powers that are the guardians that are present at a baby's particular moment in time. And here we see this, this one is someone actually who's has a lot of connection with deep consciousness. And this male power is the guardian and holding the umbilical cord of a being that's connected. Then you can see it connected to, these are stars all here in the night sky. And so after he told me this, I happened to see this codex, and I was like, here's his elder, a Nahua elder. This is before, you have to remember that this kind of teachings were before we had internet. I don't even think the elder has internet now. Before people even had access to their own knowledge in the sense of like these kinds of painted images. Before these images were put onto the internet in open access, this elder was talking about this. So we know that that's how, that the oral tradition, that knowledge existed and exists, and that we have a record through this this system of painted knowledge that we could say that each corroborate the other. And so we see one pre-Columbian, this is probably 1,000 years old, this painted book, of how our ancestors understood this from the Nahua tradition. And so this, so when we have that belly button, and I can't get into that a lot, it's a whole nother conversation. So it means then that when birth is a ceremony, and we think about the body as in ceremony, so pregnancy, not only that birth is the ceremony, but being pregnant and being in pregnancy is ceremony. Then, and that actually we are left with a ceremonial mark, which is our belly buttons. And so in traditional medicine throughout from Mexico into all the way down to the Southern Cone, the belly button is an important place of treatment, of diagnostics. There are ceremonial language that, and if you were to look at the native languages, There's a lot of examples of how it's treated ceremonially. And so, and even connected to the belly button of a fire, the belly button of a mountain, of a volcano. So that we know then that living beings, all these living beings that are present, the aliveness, there are other dimensions that aren't captured when we're talking about birth physiology. These are captured in our languages and our systems of knowledge that we have as Indigenous peoples. So I can't go too much into that, but I wanted to say that that's one example of birth as a ceremony. This is from a codex that was painted right after the invasion in central Mexico. So it is believed to be a from people who were Nahua-speaking peoples that painted this. And this is an important symbol that I can't go into. I could do a whole 5 hours on talking about the spiritual power that is the symbol of regeneration, Tlazolteo, which it translates as the principle of regeneration, and a female presiding influence over the principle of regeneration. Because, you know, in our native languages, there's like, it's not just a few words that are going to translate all of the meaning. But we can see here that there's a being, and there's little feet representing travel, and this being is traveling into her head, and she's wearing a ceremonial headdress, and the Tlazolteo is in a birthing squat, and you see then that Tlazolteo is in ceremony. She's wearing the attire of a regalia of a ceremonial leader. This is a hat representing someone with ceremonial authority. These are symbols of the moon, and throughout the headdress is symbols of the moon. They're cycles of the moon, and this is they're replicating a replica of themselves. And then you see threads of life made from the mekate, representing also the intertwined, actually also the umbilical cord. And so this is both a male and female being. And what's interesting about Tlazolteo is that it can be male and female, or have both genders within the role of this presiding force. And so we see then that birth is a ceremony. There's in ceremony, the process of birth is to produce the cycle again, and that in the process of birth, they are in ceremonial attire. So it's another way for us to think about that birth is a ceremony, and that when we are as a pregnant body, we are in ceremony, and anybody that's around that pregnant body is in ceremony. And anyone who touches, anytime we're working in medicine, those of us who are medicine keepers, we are going into ceremony when we touch another human body. And that's teachings from the elders. It's not my teaching. I'm not claiming it as my teaching. I'm sharing it as coming from our Nahua elders, that to touch another body is to go into ceremony. And so this is why then when we are working with anybody, we ask for permission from their body before we start to, even the word work, you know, doesn't capture that we're actually going into another dimension of time and space in working with a human life. And so particularly when we are working on a pregnant body. And so everyone that's around that pregnant body, including the person who is pregnant, are in ceremony. And so one of the things that is important to understand then is that the pregnant body is that womb is both a physical place and a spiritual place. And you know, in Red Medicine, I give lots of examples from elders that are talk about, there's different teachings around ways to be, because when we're in ceremony, we have our teachings about how to be in ceremony, you know, right words and right actions and being respectful and not disturbing the ceremony. So not disturbing the body that's in ceremony, that person who's in ceremony, that family that's in ceremony, that household that's in ceremony. And so then the things that you do would be as the things you would do in ceremony, in the sense of being very disciplined with your mind and your actions so that you do not bring discord into the ceremony. And of course, we know how that translates into, stress hormones for a pregnant body if there is discord as that person is in another state. So being pregnant then goes, you're going into another state with various dimensions that are operating at the same time, even if it's not recognized, because we're looking, if it's looked at more as a biological, a biological occurrence, it is actually There are multiple happenings of the body. When I say not just female, but the pregnant body, and so so this is also why in postpartum it's really important not only the lying in period, but the medicine baths that we give, and the if there's lodge. But not only that, there are times when the mom or the pregnant parent, the postpartum parent, it's gone into another dimension, and there's times when we have to go back and bring their spirit back from that other dimension, because they've gone so far. They've gone so far into these other places that are beyond human reach. The only time that people go into those spaces are when they are in pregnancy giving light, when they reach the cycle of their lifetime, or when they're in very powerful ceremonies. And so sometimes then postpartum, there are ceremonies that we do to integrate them back into this physical field. And sometimes they need to do it, and better sooner than later, but it could be years later that that happens, because there's a realization that that person hasn't totally integrated back into their system. So I want to talk about the birth powers. And I want to say, yes, I'll talk about this in time. So these are Mayan, pre-Columbian Mayan, a Mayan base. This is a really powerful base that when I was going through trying to, you know, show and connect how indigenous peoples understood birth as a ceremony, I came across this collection. So this is the line drawing. It's a little bit easier to read the painted base. That's this is a photograph of it. It's probably from 800 AD, I believe. So this is actually a depiction of a female being that's giving birth. And you can see that she's holding on to cords in the sky. And she's actually, you see a midwife clasping her belly, which is a very common practice we do to gently pray and encourage the descent of the baby. It's not a hard, it's very, you might say, energetic or ceremonial when we do this position. And it's slowly, and it's using the gravity of the earth to help descend, the baby to descend at the right time. So you can see that right here, there's some hands. Well, these are actually jaggerpaws. And you can't see it that well, but if you were to look really closely at this photograph, you could see this is a jagger midwife. And Tlazolteo, that earlier symbol that of the power of the replica of the female power, one of her symbols is the woven, spun woven, and this is a wooden, a spool of cotton in her hand. So this is someone who is the regenerative power, but also a jagger midwife with her jagger paws. So this is an example then of how the birth powers come to us at the times, actually prior to birth, prior to even going into delivery, prior to going into labor. Some midwives will notice, or the families will notice, certain signs from the natural and spiritual world that indicates that the baby is preparing to come into the physical world. And so here we see the grandma midwife, and she's also got the jagger. She's got some jagger symbols and the cotton symbols, and she's holding, you can't tell, she's holding a bowl to prepare for the placenta. And so this is an example then of, from the Mayan peoples, of the power, the spiritual powers that are the birth powers that are present at birth. And so this is also an example of why birth is ceremonial time, because in those ceremonial times, in those spiritual times, all of these alive beings, depending on what our teachings are organizing to help support the bringing of this life into the physical world. And that's why it's important for us when, to connect to our teachings, try to understand, is there someone who gazes as a star keeper? Is there someone who reads the dreams? Is there someone that can help you do a ceremony, a place of offering, in case there's a dream that indicates that we need to rebalance and shift something that so that there's optimum conditions for a birth? So birth is really a ceremonial time when we think of all of those conditions that are aligning for this life to be brought into the earth. So the spirit beings then, like, so what I love about this is that it shows us, it's depicting, yes, there are these guardians, and yes, there are midwives. So some of the old teachings about being a midwife in among indigenous midwives in Mexico, both among Zapotec, Nahua, Mixtec midwives that I've seen, have been part of prayers and been taught some of those prayers of how we call on the midwives that are in the spirit world, in the above world, in the above dimensions, in the spiritual deep dimensions that we don't see, to help us, guide us for sight, for openings, to blanket us with protection, so that we can have the best possible situation for this family or for this baby as it's coming into this world. So let me see. So I want to now talk about what happens to mama. So this is from the Borgia Codex, and this is over 1,000 years old, painted images. And this is a birthing being, and this is not a human, but this is a female that's giving life. And what I want you to see here is you'll see that right here in their eyes, there are bundles. They're actually sacred ties, and they're actually tied with starlight. And so this is representing as when anyone who's been pregnant and given birth or even also just in pregnancy will notice that you may notice your dreams get more prophetic or profound. They're giving you insight into the future. And this is why I really appreciate Gudgy Cook's teachings around the importance of following dreams, both for the pregnant mother and for the people around her and the midwife and the birth keepers. Because all the spirit world is communicating to us to help us to into the future. And so really the future is communicating to us. And so this is again an example of time. When birth, we're transcending what we understand as time. But that mother is in sacred sight. And so this is why the more the mother can be in their prayerful condition in reflexive times and not be watching TV and a lot of violent things and being distracted. And we know life is stressful, so we know that we're going to have to we're negotiating that, we're trying to realign with that reflective time, that quiet time that we can access and listen to what the natural order is trying to tell us. So we know it's a challenge today, but this shows us that is the state of life of the pregnant woman. So this prayer tie, just like those protective beings that I showed you earlier, they're actually then the protective shield. Those are ways that we have protection around us. So but because by having insight, by having, like for the Jagger medicine, or a medicine that's the, from a bear clan or clans of medicine clans that we may have, they are part of that medicine is the protection, the medicine of protection. Certain plants will be protectors and guides and witnesses to the birth. And so these are then, they act as shields, they act as openers to that, these worlds that we, that are going to open up when the birth happens. The female or the pregnant body, whether they're female or different gender identities, as they're opening up to give life, they're opening up to all of this dimensions that we cannot even articulate. They're so powerful. There are many, many dimensions that they're accessing. And so we need those protective shields when that's happening. We need help sometimes opening because we're carrying the stresses of life, the pains of what may have happened, or just the ability to connect to our body and go through that process of trusting. And I think it's just a part of our growth as human beings to experience that struggle that we may have. Not all have it, but some may struggle in different ways as they're going through the process of opening up to give life. So, so I'm going to end to talk about, I love this because this is a female ruler from the Natal Codex. She was actually a ruler. This is her story. Her name was Lady for Death. That's how they translated it in English, but which is actually not, the correct translation. But it's much more profound than that. But she's sitting on her placenta, and she's like, how many times have we seen this in birth? And even said, you have that baby, just kind of like this, you know, you go back, you know, and that baby is right there connected to the mother in the blue cord. And sometimes mama, I have seen, those placentas as round as a ball, you know, these really vibrant, very dense placentas. And she's sitting on her placenta. I know, and I've shown this to midwives who had more, have caught a lot of babies. They've seen their mama sitting on the placentas. And so they resonated with this experience of this depiction. And so we see her now also presenting the baby to the world. And so this is a whole nother aspect to the birth, as indigenous peoples, you know, birth doesn't end with the cutting of the cord. It doesn't end with the birth of the placenta. It doesn't end, until really that baby, for some, and I'm not going to say, because I know we all have different teachings, when in our own ways, we are presenting that baby to the natural world, to the spiritual world, so that that baby, they will know this child, and they will protect it, and they're aware that it's in their environment. And based on our prayers and all the guides and all the spiritual beings that are part of our sacred protectors, that they will be on watch for that child, because life can be, especially as these teachings evolve, when life could be much more precarious and we could lose a child. And we have to really, and also there's a lot of teachings about following protocols to protect that child at a time when it's still vulnerable. This is also part of the understanding, again, through a sacred time cycle, all of that relationship of other dimensions of birth that aren't captured when we only think about it as, the placenta is born and now we're going to cut the cord, or, you know, that's the end of birth, or that's the final cycle of birth. So I think I've said most of what I wanted to say. I wanted to say this, going back to our belly buttons and our first. And so the womb is our first place. It's our first place. It is the place where we find our orientation, in the sense of, like, you know, of knowing where we're at. And we become grounded and centered in that place through our words, through the words we're hearing in the womb, through the feelings of our mama, the feelings of our papa, or both mamas, or both papas, or, you know, all our parents and our grandparents, through the songs, through the smells, through the taste, through the feeling of even of how wind feels in our parents' body. And so that is our place where we find our center. And so this is why birth, the fact that we're returning to birth, means that we're returning. And I'm going to get off of this now so that I can just see y'all. I'm going to stop share. Hold on. We are returning then to our center. And I think this is part of why birth is calling so many people back, you know. And of course, not everybody, you know, we all have different ways of understanding birth. For some, it is not as ceremonial as I've taught, but we understand ceremony as being, that place of being in those respectful ways of living at a time that's very important in our child's life, that we can all, if we can think about it in that way, as we're struggling through our lives, we may be struggling with relationships. Some people may not want to be pregnant again, or you know, they're struggling. They could be struggling with the idea of being pregnant, or they could be worried about money. They could be afraid to go to the doctors right now, or go outside. But they are in ceremony, and if we can really encourage people to understand that they are in their own sacred process, it can give them great relief and strength, so that they have a better, they feel more power in this moment that is of great power for them during this sacred cycle. So.
Beautiful. Thank you, Patricia. At this time, and I'd love to just hear in particular from anyone who's currently pregnant.
Well, let me ask, because I see a few people that I know here. I see Mariana, and was Melissa still here? Melissa Lewis, I saw Melissa was there.
I'm here.
Yeah, I don't know. Melissa, do you want to say anything? Does this resonate at all with some your what happened with, you know, your birth, or you know, also your you know, the entire cycle of your birth?
Yes, all of it. Trying to think what would be something that might be interesting to share. You touched on several things that I suppose were part of my personal experience with my son, who is 2 years old now. Here, I suppose I could do the video too. So Patricia assisted me when Amai wanted to sort of stay in the right part of my belly. That's where he felt comfortable, and she spoke with him, and it was a beautiful conversation, and he decided to listen to his auntie and kind of stay down the middle. You know, I had a home birth in water, and it was a challenging pregnancy for me, and the birth was no different. He was a large baby, and he came relatively quick. My water broke at midnight, and he was born right before 8 a.m. And Patricia assisted me in many ways throughout, but wasn't able to be there in person. But I did lose enough blood between the time that I had birthed him and that I, before the placenta was birthed, that I went unconscious. And during that time, and I don't mind sharing it, and Patricia and other birth workers have sort of explained that what has happened is I went to a different place, and I had to work, and I still need to work to kind of stay here. In some ways, I like to think I had to go grab him from the other place, but I went a little too far, and you know, it took a while to feel back in my body, and I'm not sure if I actually 100% do feel back in my body. And it was interesting that several different people told me the same thing, all Indigenous birth workers, and some of the protocol that I need to do. And I knew that this was true, because even after his birth, I had quite a few issues. Again, Patricia assisted me with and different medicines that helped with nursing, but they only worked for a very short amount of time. So I knew I needed to do work on myself to be back here. But it was a very powerful and obviously life-changing experience. I could go on, but I'll stop there.
Thank you, Melissa. No, Mariana, do you want to say anything? You're listening so intently, but I just know that, you know, I kind of was, you know, I wasn't part of the birth, but, you know, I know that you have a mother-in-law who's like in red medicine, is so knowledgeable around birth, and Rhonda was at your birth. I don't know if, you know.
Sorry to put you on the spot.
I mean, but, you don't have to, but I'm just saying it might resonate with some of your experience.
Yeah. Well, I guess this is to preface this. I get to share with my partner in a few weeks on this platform. Rhonda invited us to share about our birth and just parenthood. But I read your book, and Rhonda was my midwife, and I think it's having that type of support. Like, I want that for every birthing family. And I think my birth, I felt really empowered and just really supported throughout my pregnancy. And I speaking to like my closest friends and just other people that have given birth, my experience in comparison to others seems so rare to be able to. I had a midwife that accepted my Medicaid. I had a midwife that would sit with me for, you know, more than an hour, sometimes a couple hours, and ask me about my dreams, ask me about how I'm feeling. I think it almost felt unfair in some ways to kind of share about this experience, because it seems so rare and unique to a lot of my friends. And I really tapped into these types of communities, like the Indigenous Birth Keepers Gathering, that was the Salish Seas ones that was hosted. I was just a few weeks pregnant when it was hosted here in Olympia, where I live, that Rhonda brought together. And so I feel really lucky. I guess I just wanted to say that much, that these platforms are so incredibly important for people to just hear stories of reclaiming their birth. I'm Yakima, my partner's Mexica, Nahua, and also Apache. And so, you know, we really kind of looked at how do we blend the teachings that we have. And I think it was really fascinating. I don't even know if fascinating is not the right word. It was real to find out how much knowledge is and isn't there around birth and reclaiming birth. And like, just even in my own tribal community, like, I learned a lot of like what I'm not supposed to do, but there wasn't a lot of to do, like, don't do this, don't do this, don't do this. And there was less of like, and do this and do that, or how do you follow, you know, the teaching of not doing it, and then trying to think through with curiosity of what those protocols might be trying to support us with. And I really, now that my son's a month and, or a year and 3 months old, and I'm still like just so fascinated with birthing bodies and birth and childhood and parenting. And I'm just so grateful for the work that you all carry and what you've put out. And yes, like Itza's mom, my partner's mom, Maria de la Cruz, is a, I think what you would call a lay midwife, and just supported a bunch of amazing women giving birth at home. And she was trying to be here for the birth, but made it a couple days later. But I gave birth at home and in the water, and we'll share more, I guess, about that story soon. But I just appreciate the people that really create space for us to do it. And I've just been thinking so much about birthing folks right now. And thank you for having these spaces.
Yeah, I think one thing for the birth workers, I mean, I was trying to think about both the parents and but the birth workers. Mariana was mentioning, you know, she's Yakima, but you know, Rhonda is from another nation, and so the important thing for the birth workers is for you all, for us to be in our own ceremony. But one's, how do we support a mom? And, you know, here we have different nations that are, with their traditions, reclaiming birth. And then there's the midwife and the birth workers. And I think that that's also really important, is that you have to be rested enough to pay attention. And it's hard, you know, if you're having to hustle and it's not your full-time job, you know, you have to take time so that when you're in the actual the ceremony of labor, that you can listen and notice the signs that are not going to be maybe physical. Some of it may be dreams. Some of it is like your knowing that comes forward. You know, where is that knowing coming from? It's coming from whether you're in prayer or ceremony, or you're having that time to like go inward, so that you can really help the family or that parent that's going through birth. And so, and how do you, you know, bring your bundle then to that you might be with a family that's not traditional, you know, and so then, you know, you know, how do you rely then on your inner process, so that, they're not offended by your bundle, or they're not, you know, you're careful to respect whatever their ways are. And so sometimes, I think that's important. Okay, let me see. I have Aspen. Okay. Wanting to recognize so that we have so what are so important. Right. So I think this is how then, wow, you know, I've seen so many great examples of how people are starting to bring back birth. I remember when I was at a conference in Minnesota, I had met these Ojibwe, and one of the ways that they did it, this was like already 13 years ago, I don't know how far they've gone with it, they started to bring back the cradle board teachings. And then from that, then it sparked a conversation around what they knew around birds. So I think sometimes you have to kind of maybe do it in a circular way about other things that people do care about. Could be the cradle board, could be naming ceremonies, could be, I know that that's an issue. It's a real issue because a lot of tribes, also women, have really gotten used to birthing at a hospital or a clinic. And they also, they're comfortable with that. It could be around reclaiming language, just thinking about what do our words tell us about being pregnant or the baby or the umbilical cord or the placenta. So I don't know if Rhonda or anybody else want to contribute to that question for Aspen.
I think that what I would also like to add is that I think that we don't have to have this idea that everything is just a vision that we have, and that for some people feeling powerful in their birth might be, that they were fed this beautiful traditional meal after they returned home, or that, they had this a blanket that they could wrap in that, was from an elder that felt really important to them. And so I think that the not wanting to recognize, so just for people, the question was, how can I support my young Taos Pueblo families that aren't wanting to recognize their traditions and birth customs? And I think that it's that piece of, people are, with any ceremony, and that's, the theme of today, that with any of those ceremonies, we're holding space. We're holding space for people, and that whatever pieces they connect with, and whatever the places they connect with other people that are outside of the birth keepers that are with them, that we just try and open that up for them. And so I find often it's with plants and foods and language and, gentle traditions, and maybe it's a postpartum healing ceremony, or maybe it's, just that support around, first foods and feeding their baby, and that whatever pieces that families choose to invite into their birth are all just beautiful. And so I just want to open that up, that I think that the more people have an idea of what birth can look like, and the more traditions that people savor and bring into their birth experience, the more that will be shared for all the generations after them. And so I have to remember that. And then we had a couple other questions, Patricia. So one person asked that they're interested to learn more about star knowledge in regards to birth.
So I would say that it's important to go back start with your own elders about what they say about the stars. There are certainly teachings that I have from my great-grandpa about the stars, and that's what's guided me. And I would say start, if you don't have a way to connect with that, go out under the night and go and have a connection with those stars and ask for that star knowledge to come back to you. That again, then you're going into the world of prayers and the aliveness of creation, and you will start to have messages. So part of it is being able to understand how to connect to the night sky and all the teachings of the night sky.
Hi, I had a question. Hi, my name's Siri. I'm pregnant with my first kid. And earlier today I was talking with my mom, or she was sharing some names with me about that follow like our naming protocols and everything. And she mentioned a name that translates to first light, and I heard you say the baby's first light. I was babysitting, so I didn't catch everything you said, but that's the second time I heard it today, so I was just wondering if you could just repeat that small part real quick.
Okay. So what I was saying is that we come from the four elements. You know, our body constitutes from the four elements. That's what gives us life. And so so our light, when we think about, well, where will our light go back to once we have made our transition, when our time is up in this physical world? Our light will go back to the light. Our water will go back to the water. Our air, our breath will go back to the wind or the air. And our body will go back to the earth. But there's other first lights. I mean, there's the first light of dawn. There's the first light of the moon. There could be the first light of a particular star. There could be the first light that enters into you and makes who you are. So there could be the electrical impulse of the first light in your body that sparks life. If there's a lot of first lights, so it'd be interesting to see what your mama, how she understands that, or your grandparents, or your aunties and uncles.
For the next bit of time, we're gonna transition over to Cammie, and be thinking about, you know, we have all those first lights that Patricia mentioned, and that also that journey of birth is also, and that ceremony of birth is also part of that welcoming a new child and continuing supporting the growth of that life. And so with each of these episodes, I'd really love for us to be remembering that, you know, the birth and the parenting journey are side by side, and for us to be having as much support and energy for all the different stages of us being birthed as parents and as caregivers and people that are trying to love and help support our generations. And so I want to just move for this next bit of time over to Cammie Goldhammer. And then if you have other questions, feel free to just keep putting them in the box. And then we will move into those after this in a half an hour.
Hi, everybody. I am so happy that you're all here, and I'm so grateful to Rhonda for the invitation to share a little bit about breastfeeding and breast milk. And I'm very, very grateful to Patricia for your teachings, and it's hard to go after you. But I will do my best. So I'm Cammie Goldhammer. I am Sisseton Wahpeton from South Dakota, but my family has been in the land of the Duwamish people for two, three generations now. My grandma came here during boarding school era and relocation. And I'm a lactation consultant and a clinical social worker. Along with my best friend and colleague, who's also sharing on this call, Kim, her and I travel the country, and someday we'll get to Canada and teach the Indigenous Breastfeeding Counselor training. So we train Indigenous people as breastfeeding peer counselors. It's a 5-day 45-hour foundational breastfeeding course. I am speaking to you from my office. I snuck into my office today. My quote-unquote day job is I'm the program manager for Daybreak Star Doulas, which is a doula program for Indigenous pregnant and parenting and birthing people in King County. And we're a program of United Indians of All Tribes, which is one of our urban Native organizations here in Seattle. So Rhonda and I talked a couple weeks ago about what to talk about. And for those of you that know me, you know I could talk about breastfeeding, and particularly when it comes to Indigenous people breastfeeding, for hours, literally. So we knew that we had to make this pretty compact. And she had said, like, what's like just something you can speak a little bit about, you know, a shorter amount of time. And we kind of nailed it down on colostrum. And it's so interesting, like, Patricia and I did not talk at all about what we were going to be sharing. And I feel like even just like my slide doc feels really appropriate to follow hers and talking about the stars. And I have a poem at the end of this talking about colostrum that relates to the stars as well. So I have, you know, 20 minutes probably at this point to just share a little bit of information about colostrum. My plan for this is for it to be mostly, again, informational. I recognize that those of you that are on this call, we have folks that are in the process of growing life and bringing new life to this, to the world, and then we have folks that serve pregnant and parenting people, whether that's as doulas or midwives or home visitors, and there's just a lot of information out there, and seeing the way, you know, the questions about the first few days after birth and feeding a baby and breastfeeding a baby and what that's like, I find that the discussion around colostrum in our first milk is something that we don't spend a lot of time learning about and talking about. And it's, you know, I see it as a bit of a gap. So I want to also kind of preface this for how I really perceive breastfeeding and in the context of which I speak about breastfeeding, so that you all kind of understand where I'm coming from. So I see, like we just talked about, birth as ceremony and birth as a cultural practice. I see breastfeeding as the same thing. I think that when we look at communities that have maintained the tradition of breastfeeding for generations, the one thing that they have that other communities don't have is grandmothers that breastfed. They all have problems, right? Everyone around the world is concerned about milk, how much milk they make. Everybody, you know, and I shouldn't say everybody, but these are really common experiences of lactating people. How much milk we make, sore nipples, infections, right? Those are not things that just Americans and Europeans get. We see that everywhere. But the difference is that some of these communities have grandmothers and great-grandmothers with that traditional knowledge of how to support these people through the challenges that they're experiencing, right? If you have a baby that is cluster feeding in their third week of life, in a community that has maintained that tradition of breastfeeding, you would have a grandmother that would say, oh no, you know, like, no, your baby's, it's not that you're not making enough milk. Your baby's cluster feeding and this is really normal. They're growing. Why don't you go ahead and get in bed and I'm going to make you some soup and tea, right? Like that's the process that would happen versus now in a lot of communities where we don't have that. And, you know, talking about in specifically around Native communities, and this would be a whole other presentation, but for many of us, no one has breastfed in our families for several generations, right? And that's been due to the child welfare system, the boarding school system, war, famine, relocation. I mean, we can go back to 1492 and see how parenting has been interrupted by and through colonial, as a result of colonialism. And so, you know, for a lot of our families, we don't have that traditional knowledge anymore. We don't have someone that knows what to do. And that's a lot of the work that Kim and I do together is really bringing this knowledge back to the community where it belongs so that they can then serve the people they live around, right? So that the Indigenous breastfeeding counselors can serve people in their tribal communities because that's where it belongs, right? This knowledge belongs with community members. So To jump in and just talk about colostrum is, colostrum is awesome. It's one of my favorite things. Colostrum is breast milk. So I first want to like really stress that language that I as a lactation consultant will rarely talk about, say things like, well, this is colostrum, and when your milk comes in, or when, you know, that kind of stuff, because that makes them sound like colostrum isn't milk, and colostrum is milk. It's a really, really, really special milk on top of that. We start making colostrum usually in the second trimester, kind of midway through the second trimester. Sometimes folks are making it sooner, especially if they've had a couple of kiddos, right? So their bodies kind of know what to do and start getting ready to feed that baby. But it's one of the first things our body does when it's getting, when it recognizes that it's pregnant, is it starts getting ready to feed that baby and developing in a way to feed that baby. We make it throughout our pregnancy, and it is all a baby needs in the first few days of their life. And so here I have one of my favorite pictures of a Blackfeet family. This was taken at Blackfeet Memorial Hospital. And I got to do some work there around them going baby friendly several years ago, but this is a daughter that just gave birth to her baby, and her mother is helping with the first feed, which is traditionally who should be helping with the first feed, right? This is typically not where lactation consultants or nurses, like if we have a grandmother that can do this, or that we can teach them to help and support that first feed, like that's such an important role for them, and such an important rite of passage for them as grandparents or as aunties, right? Or great aunties to move to help with this first feed. So a little bit about colostrum, a little bit more about colostrum is we do make very small amounts of it. Colostrum, I remind parents all the time, is not there to grow a baby. It is not a milk that is full of growth components. This is why it's very normal for a breastfed baby to lose a little bit of weight after they're born. That's to be expected because we want them to be getting colostrum, which again isn't there to grow a baby. It's really there to inoculate the baby and give them this really beautiful, fresh start to life and into this new world. There we go. So when talking about colostrum, the other thing that I often say is that breast milk is our first food. It is a baby's traditional first food. And I feel that it's essential that breast milk and breastfeeding be included in first food justice conversations and food sovereignty conversations. The current rates for breastfeeding in the United States when it comes to Native families is that just about 7 in 10 Native families choose to breastfeed on day one, so they want to breastfeed. And by about 6 months, just about 9% of babies are being exclusively breastfed. Native babies are being exclusively breastfed at 6 months. And for those of you that aren't aware, we want 100% of babies being exclusively breastfed till 6 months. And so we have a huge disparity there as far as our rates and the breastfeeding rates in our community. So I when I talk about breast milk as a first food, and when we talk about it as a foundational food, I always say, like, it doesn't matter how much salmon we eat, how much elk we eat, how much wild rice we eat, corn, beans, squash, none of that matters if 90% of our babies are not getting their first traditional food, which is breast milk, right? Like that really lays this foundation for their health and their well-being. So let's talk a little bit more about Classroom and what it does. So the first thing that it does is it really builds the baby's immune system. Colostrum is actually in our breast milk as long as we're lactating. It is the immune layer in breast milk. It's just that as a baby gets older, our milk then has more essentially water and sugar. Of course, there's other nutrients that change and grow with the baby as well. But the immune layer that stays in milk is colostrum. And so breast milk at the beginning of breastfeeding, colostrum is very similar to our breast milk at the end of breastfeeding, right? When we have a four-year-old that's nursing every couple days, right? They're growing and getting most of their nutrients from other foods, from their family foods, things like that. Where breastfeeding is really important for them is still to get that immune layer, right? The immunities that are in breast milk. And so the milk is going to be much more concentrated at the end of breastfeeding because the baby is not, or child isn't nursing as much as they were when they were 3 months old. Does that, hopefully that makes sense. So the thing that I think is so cool about breast milk, and for those of you that are pregnant and listening to this, or, you know, I think that, that this is just like the neatest stuff. So what happens is from the time you become pregnant until the time you have your baby, we are walking throughout our world, right? And right now is actually pretty difficult because most of us are actually not leaving our homes very much. We're in this really interesting time right now, but typically we would be going out in our community. We would be touching countertops and going to the grocery store and exchanging money and going to a restaurant and being around people and hugging and kissing relatives and family. And what we're doing during that time when we're pregnant is we are telling our body what antibodies it needs to create to protect this baby that's going to be born in the next few months, right? So we're really spending those 9 months learning about the diseases and illnesses and sicknesses and germs that are in the baby's environment that they're going to be born into, right? And our body then creates antibodies against all of those illnesses for the entire, you know, 9 months of our pregnancy. Hopefully we recognize that some babies are born much earlier than that, but this starts right when we become pregnant. And all of that knowledge that we gathered throughout our pregnancy around those germs and illnesses and diseases is stored in our colostrum. And so when our baby is born and we feed them colostrum, that first food for the first few days of their life, they are getting essentially inoculated. It's a vaccine at birth, right? They're getting inoculated and getting antibodies against all of those things that their parent has been around over the last year of that pregnancy, right? So it's really, really cool how that happens. And this is why babies that just are breastfed for 1 day or 2 days after they're born have better postpartum outcomes than babies who never get the chance to breastfeed, right? So even 1 day makes a difference. The other thing that it does is it really primes the baby's gut. It's important to remember that for newborn humans, especially, but other mammals as well, that our babies are born very early, and the gut, the barrier between the gut and the rest of the baby's body is actually open. It's permeable, and it can things can go in and out, right? And what colostrum does is it primes the baby's gut. It's like putting on that thick layer of primer when you paint a wall, right? That really protects the baby from and protects their gut. So that's a really important piece of it. And this is why for babies that are born premature, which our native babies are more likely to become be born premature, why breastfeeding is so important for them. It's very protective against things like NEC, which is a bacterial infection that is very dangerous for premature babies, and is almost non-existent in babies that are breastfed. So the risk factors for it are being born premature and being formula fed. And so for our babies that are born premature, it's just really important that they get colostrum, that they get breast milk as much as possible. The other thing that colostrum does is it helps our baby poop that meconium, right? Hopefully they have not pooped the entire time they've been inside. We recognize that sometimes it happens in labor, you know, or something like that, especially both my kids are 42 weekers and one of mine, you know, pooped in labor, the other one didn't, but you know, they've been holding in all that waste the entire time they've been developing in utero. And so colostrum serves as a laxative for them to clear out that system and clear out that meconium, and get ready for, you know, outside living, things like that. It also helps to prevent jaundice and regulates babies' blood sugars. So when babies are jaundiced, or if there are, or their sugars are, you know, too high or too low, we want them to be breastfed. We want them to get colostrum because that's going to just put them in a better position for staying healthy. And it really is this perfect first food. It is so yummy. It's sweet. It's, we call it liquid gold. It is filled with the perfect nutrients that your newborn baby needs. And it is just the right amount. So we make about 1 to 2 teaspoons a breast, which is just enough to fill the baby's tummy. And this is why they eat so often, because the colostrum is perfectly designed for them. It serves as a laxative, and so it goes in and it comes right back out. And that's why an hour later they're hungry, or an hour and a half later they're hungry again, or 45 minutes later they're hungry, right? That's exactly what we would expect for a baby in the first few days of their life, and how we would expect them to eat. So it's a perfect first food. It's so, so good for them, and is such a gift to be able to give to them as well. This is the short poem I was saying, like, just felt so appropriate following Patricia's presentation. And it's a short poem by Amisha Begwat, and it's titled Colostrum, and it says, "Hand folded mother, spread the stardust in colostrum to bloom her child." And I think that that's just a really beautiful sentiment of what breast milk does. And we have a lot of traditional teachings across many of our communities around breast milk and the role that breast milk plays in sharing our stories, right? And that we don't actually have to speak our stories to our babies, that we can do that through our milk and through that connection that we have when we breastfeed our babies. And so that was so fast. I've never actually spoken that fast about anything. So I'm like, if there's any questions.
So I can you see the chat bar right now?
I can.
Okay. So if you want to just.
Yes. Okay. So Mariana says, okay, thank you. You're welcome. All right. She says, "I have a question about breastfeeding while pregnant. What are the best protocols for a pregnant person to care for themselves? What, if any, are concerns to breastfeeding while pregnant, and any resources and suggestions breastfeeding toddler?" Oh my gosh. Okay. And I just got to say, Kim right below you, who's my bestie, my breastie, she says, yep, that was the fastest. So Kim can attest that was unusual for me. So breastfeeding while pregnant. First of all, I'll say there's not a lot of resources out there about breastfeeding while pregnant, unfortunately. There's one book that La Leche League published called Adventures in Tandem Nursing that is actually a pretty decent book, if you're a reader and that's something that you like to do. But this is what I'll say about breastfeeding while pregnant. And I'll talk about this as like an LC and also as someone who breastfed while pregnant. So my kids are 2.5 years apart, and my oldest weaned when she was 4. So I breastfed through my pregnancy and an additional 18 months. I breastfed the two of them together. And so I have, you know, kind of just like personal knowledge and then just like lactation knowledge too around it. So this is what I'll say is one is it's a very, very normal to breastfeed while pregnant. Like that is something that I'll just right off the bat say it is okay to do. In general, what we say, kind of the rule is if you have the okay to have sex, then you have the okay to breastfeed. The reason why some providers might tell someone that they should consider weaning their baby or toddler while they're pregnant, or that they can't breastfeed while they're pregnant, something like that, is that they are concerned about preterm labor, because oxytocin is is the love hormone that makes our milk flow. So we have very high levels of it while breastfeeding. And oxytocin, for a lot of you know, is the hormone that also makes our uterus contract, right? And so that's why there's some, you know, some providers who aren't super familiar with this, which most of them are not familiar with it. That's why some of them will say you need to wean, because they think that those contractions, the oxytocin surges, will make the uterus contract and cause someone to go into preterm labor. What we know is that the oxytocin surges and the contractions that that are caused by breastfeeding are not any more than what someone would have in an orgasm or something like that, you know. So that's why we say, like, if as long as you're okay to have sex, then you're okay to breastfeed. So someone that's maybe having a high-risk pregnancy that's on pelvic rest, something like that, then that might be a person that should have further discussions with their providers about the safety of continuing breastfeeding. But overall, most people are able to do it. It's really common when you're pregnant and breastfeeding to not love it. So there's that piece, which we don't spend a lot of time talking about and talking about really truthfully around it. And I say, you know, even as like a huge breastfeeding advocate who wants to talk about all the wonderful things about breastfeeding, there are also some times that are really hard. And I'd say anyone that has gone on to breastfeed toddlers or breastfeed through a pregnancy, you come into those challenges, right? Like they can be difficult. So typically what will happen is biology takes over. So when we become pregnant, the body gets ready for a new baby. So what first happens usually, and since I was breastfeeding a 2.5-year-old, my 2.5-year-old was able to verbalize each of these steps. So I actually didn't find out I was pregnant until about 11 weeks postpartum, or sorry, 11 weeks pregnant. And, but my toddler had been telling me things about my milk that I didn't know what it meant, but she had said things like mama nookie ucky, right? So nookie is what she called milk, and she said it tasted bad. And I was like, what? Oh my gosh. You know, like, what are you talking about? And then she told me that my nookie was all gone. Right? And she was like, nookie all gone. And I was like, what? And breastfeeding started to hurt, right? Out of nowhere after 2.5 years of really wonderful, you know, nursing. And it was because my body was getting ready and preparing for this new baby. And it is doing this in a way to try and wean the child, right? Because it's saying like, new kiddos coming. And so it's really, it's not uncommon for a younger toddler, so a 1-year-old, 1.5-year-old, would maybe wean during a pregnancy, right? They might not be into that ucky milk, or, you know, or dry nursing, or, you know, something like that. But a kiddo that's 2, 2.5, 3, I say they're in it to win it. So they're usually going to just keep going. They don't really care what it tastes like or how much is there. They are their game. And so, So that's just something to keep in mind too, that the body is going to start preparing and reset for that new baby in an effort to kind of wean the toddler. And it's okay if the toddler weans. That's a really normal reason for a toddler to wean, is because a new baby is coming, and it's also really normal for them to continue breastfeeding. It just depends on the kiddo. So as far as concerns, I'd say like pain is one thing to think about. You know, nursing aversions can be really common when you're pregnant, and breastfeeding, you know, it can just feel kind of like, ugh, like, you know, just a lot. Typically that does end at the end of the first trimester. Usually, you know, the pain and discomfort does go away. The aversion might continue, right? And so that's where I think boundaries, things like that with the toddler, are really appropriate to put in place to make sure that you're comfortable. And this is a great time for kiddos to learn boundaries, right? And learn respect of body and autonomy, and that your body is your body. And then just taking care of yourself, right? You're growing a baby and you're continuing to feed a child. And so, you know, we know that being pregnant already takes a lot out of you as a person, and we tend to need more calories, things like that. And that might be the case also if you're nursing on top of that, right? So just being really careful about nourishing your body, staying hydrated, things like that. And then just always checking in with yourself and saying, like, is this still working for me? Is my suggestion. So yeah, I feel like that's about it. For anyone on here, definitely feel free to reach out to me. Tandem nursing and nursing while pregnant is one of my little niches that I just love to share information about and talk about, because I say it's not for the birds. It's not for everybody. It was, you know, like, even as someone who loves, loves, loves breastfeeding, it was one of the hardest things ever. And at the same time, it was one of the things that I don't regret a minute of it. And I am convinced my children are soulmates because they shared nursing together, right? They got to do that together. And I think that is largely why their bond is so close. So there's these really beautiful moments of it. And then there's these other times where it's just like the hardest thing ever. So those experiences are not mutually exclusive.
I wanted to say something, Cammy. Thank you for your presentation. So I would say from my own elder, Nana Filo, because I used to ask her about this with tandem, and her recommendation was, and again, this is just another way to think about it. She would say that the milk, the reason to wean off for a period is because the milk sours, and it sours from the changes in the body. So that makes sense with what you were saying, that sometimes it becomes not tasteful, I guess, to the baby, to the sibling, right? To the toddler. So I think one thing is also important, just if, when we have them, we don't always have teachings of what that says, you know, why we should continue breastfeeding.
Absolutely. I've met several people that for some random reason, they taste their milk, right? And it tastes bad, like sour. What we really see is sodium levels increase quite a bit when someone's pregnant. And so that it can taste salty or have, you know, like that flavor. And it could be interpreted as sour or kind of like a ripe flavor. And they think that their milk is bad, right? That it's going bad or something's wrong with it. And so they'll choose to wean during that time. And then they have, you know, teachings from others in the community that say that too, even though they don't quite know what is going on, right? And again, we have to recognize that we have this, you know, in large part, this gap in our education, right? We have, you know, several generations that on a large scale didn't breastfeed. And so we don't have that traditional knowledge that's really immersed in the community. Yeah, just sharing that information with them is great, and explaining it, right? And just explaining what's going on a biological level, what's happening. So
I'll also just say that it's pretty sweet to see, you know, so when a toddler, I mean, their whole world is about to shift, but it's about to just be so much bigger and lovelier. And it's also been really sweet to see families that, you know, they maybe, you know, they didn't have room on the lap so much, and, you know, they had to share, and there was a lot of change. Maybe, you know, the parents went to the hospital for a few days, and it was the first time they'd been away, something like that. And then the milk is the way that they remember. And they're like, I'll share my lap because this is so delicious. And they remember, and they're so, so happy to have that sweet milk return. That it comes with the present of the baby, you know, the sweet milk and their new sibling, you know, come together, and that can be
totally
really sweet.
I remember with my oldest Dylan, who's 11, she turned 11 on Sunday. And when my milk transitioned from, you know, colostrum to that copious milk supply. And for me, it happened fairly quickly. For most people, it's going to be between days 3 and 4. For folks that have had a couple of kids, for those of us that were nursing a toddler, or maybe you have multiples that you're nursing, it can sometimes happen faster. So with my second, it happened about 18 hours postpartum. And I remember nursing my baby in the middle of the night, and I recognized that my milk had transitioned, right? She was gulping, she was doing, you know, it was, the milk was plentiful. And I remember thinking, like, smiling to myself and saying, Dylan's gonna be so excited. You know, like, my oldest is gonna be so excited. And so her and I actually got up in the morning and we sat down in the chair. And we nursed. That was just part of our morning wake up routine, right? It was we nursed. And it was just her and I at that point. And we're sitting in the chair and she latched and my milk, you know, let down and started flowing. And she just looked up at me, you know, with like boob in her mouth and her eyes filled with tears. And they just like rolled down her cheeks and she just like nuzzled in to drink some more, you know? And I just remember thinking like, I always say, I wish that was our last time we nursed because it was so beautiful. And then it was like the next year and a half was like, oh my gosh, this is so exhausting. But it was just this really beautiful moment. She was so happy, like so happy that it was back. So and it's also really great, you know, for, I never had clogged ducts. You have a toddler that can really help regulate the supply, you know, things like that, less chance of infection. Because you have an additional nursling that you can say like, hey, come over here. Like, I need you to get on. I'm feeling a little full, that kind of stuff. So, yeah.
Thank you. This next question feels really important. And maybe we can speak about it both in terms of just birth as a ceremony and with breastfeeding. And that is the, you know, this challenge of having some places where some generations had a lot of that disturbance and a lot of colonial influences that have harmed, you know, those, the people that we really treasure, them in our lives and all that they offer us. And so the question it was, you know, how would you suggest confronting misinformation being shared about breastfeeding, particularly within our tribal communities? And then also the discouraging comments and suggestions while still respecting the grandmas and aunties who are sharing them. And that both, I'd love to just hear from both of you in pieces of this.
Do you want to go first, Patricia?
Well, I think you're the better expert. I do want to say something about that, though. I guess maybe... I want to talk about the struggling of the milk supply because I think part of the trauma, I think I should answer the other one about struggling with milk supply and talk about the emotions. So why don't you go with this one?
Yeah, so I think that this is one very common across communities. I've gone to dozens of communities across Turtle Island, and this is a common I would even venture to say happens in every community, you know, that we go to, as far as particularly elders, our matriarchs, and them being discouraging, sharing misinformation, things like that, and kind of undermining, you know, what can sometimes look like undermining breastfeeding. And then how do we confront that is difficult because we have our teachings around respecting our elders, respecting their teachings. And sometimes it can seem like if we disagree with them, that is disrespecting them, right? And so I want to first recognize the difficulty of the position that we are often in this situation. What I would want to want folks to do, and I'm sure Rachel, you recognize this, or for other folks in community to recognize, is that these matriarchs are grieving, right? They're largely grieving the loss of an experience that they often did not get. And that is really, really difficult, right? That's a difficult position to be in. Our matriarchs are so important to our communities. They often are the heads of our families. They're the ones we go to for knowledge and experience. And then when it comes to breastfeeding, they may not have that information, right? But they are seen as the one that the person to protect the family, right? Protect the family from, and I, again, could do like a whole other presentation on the impacts of historical trauma on breastfeeding in particular. But that's a lot of times what I'm seeing, right? Is that our elders, our matriarchs, our patriarchs are scared of our babies being taken away. They're scared of our babies not getting enough food, right? They're really, really concerned about that stuff, and they see their role as protecting that baby. And so for me, what I like to do, and this is the therapist in me, right? Like the social worker, is often asking question, you know, kind of like open-ended questions about that, of, you know, where did you learn that? Tell me more about your thoughts around that. Asking if it's appropriate to share additional information. I always find asking about what their experience was with breastfeeding is really important, right? And giving them the space to process that experience, because for a lot of them, they've been holding it in for 50, 60 years, right? That they didn't get that experience. And now they're seeing their daughter or their niece or their granddaughter attach and bond with their baby in such a different way, right? And I remember like my mom saying it to me, like she's like, she recognized that my bond with my kids was different than hers with me, right? And that it doesn't mean it's better or worse. So it's not putting a value judgment on that relationship at all. It's more of recognizing that there's a loss there and there's a grief. This is where I also think like giving the information, so like you as a CLC and a nursing parent, continuing to provide that information to the community members so that they can be the experts, right? So a lot of times when I'm working with a multi-generational family, I am often talking to the matriarch in the room, right? I'm explaining how to help with the latch. I'm explaining a growth spurt. I'm explaining, you know, as much as I possibly can to that grandma, because I want her to be the expert, right? I want her later on in the middle of the night when she's all that there is to remember, like, oh yeah, I learned about the growth spurt. Like I remember that. That's all that's happening. So that she can feel really empowered to support their daughter or niece or whoever it is in breastfeeding. I think, too, there's some community work that could be done, you know, talking circles for grandmothers or great-grandmothers. I've also always said, like, you know, we don't need to be teaching breastfeeding classes to pregnant people. Give us the grandmas, right? Get their moms and aunties in the room and let's spend 3 hours with them talking about breastfeeding and how to support breastfeeding. We don't even need to tell the pregnant people this stuff, right? Give it to the grandmas so that they can share it with their pregnant person that's in their life. You know, so again, maybe talking circles, maybe some, you know, community conversations, grandmother's teas, things like that. And then, you know, just doing some more digging too with them about what they're feeling, what they're experiencing, I think can help a little bit too.
Thank you. Patricia, do you want to answer the next one?
Yeah, this is about traditional medicines with women struggling. One of the things I wanted to say about breastfeeding from a traditional perspective is a real common belief in Mexico is that if a mother's grieving or has a lot of trauma or is really stressed out, that the baby will suckle the grief of the mother. And so now, and it changes even the milk. So this is why, you know, the levels of stress, obviously, so because it goes to this question about a woman's milk supply from the woman from Peru. And so, you know, we know now through Western sciences that if a mother is stressed, that the baby's heart will start to beat at the same heart rhythm rate as the mother, right? So we know that there's biological connections between the baby, the mother and child. So if a mother's stressed, then it can, so that's just another way for us to think about how it's impacting their milk supply, the stress hormones. But also, so when you're talking about herbs for a milk supply, and of course, Rhonda knows a lot about all kinds of things for the milk supply, but I think it's not just about producing herbs for milk, because like fennel is one that's used in a lot of places. The Cynthia's mentioning a fennel, but you know, we have nettles, which is ortiga in Spanish, Cynthia. So when you're looking at herbs, it might be that also they're low on minerals or their nutrition. So when we're looking from a traditional perspective on what we give a postpartum, it's interesting because a lot of people talk about bone soup, which we don't really call it that. We just give people caldo because, you know, most of the time our animals have bones in them. Because they take the whole chicken or they take the side of a particular animal and they just cut it up and they include the bones in it. So sometimes it's through nutrition, it's sometimes it's through teas, but it's also looking at what is the nutritional load of the mother or the emotional load of the mother or the family. And so then we need to also look at what kind of stressors are happening in the family that could be impacting the milk production, or they might have some postpartum, you know, the beginning of postpartum depression that's not really diagnosed. And this is why our traditional medicine baths are really important for that, because it starts to help them sweat out the hormones that are in oversupply that also could be impeding the production of milk or even perhaps depression might be setting in that they're not aware of. So I think it's a really complex, it can be a complex picture. So you have to look at it from all kinds of ways as far as their level of minerals. They're also, what are they carrying? You know, what are their stresses? And then also what kind of nutrition? So usually postpartum, we're not giving them cold foods. So for us, it's like the cold and the hot, like the cold properties. So it might be different someplace where, like I know Rhonda, you know, we were talking about some of your traditions that we wouldn't normally do because we're not near cold and wet and a lot of water, you know, traditions. But when it's someplace like Alaska, that would be perfectly normal and part of a ceremony because you're in a colder climate. So it's just going to also depend on our different traditions that we have from where we're at and where in the places that we're at, you know. So if the woman has a lot of coldness or the parent has a lot of coldness in their body, maybe they need that heated up so there's more circulation. So that also can contribute to things like their milk supply. So that's a little bit more on the, you know, on the side of the person helping assist in birth care and postpartum care. But I would look at it from all of those different perspectives. And I wanted to go back to, as somebody asked a question about going too far in the dimensions, so maybe we can go back to that later. I don't know, Cami, do you want to respond to this question from Cynthia?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's important to also recognize that low supply, and it sounds like this parent that you're speaking of specifically does have a low supply, because baby isn't gaining, still below birth weight, that kind of stuff, which is pretty concerning. There's a lot of reasons why someone could have low milk supply. Typically, breastfeeding is a supply and demand endeavor, so the more someone breastfeeds, the more milk they make. But that is assuming that we have a baby that is doing their part and pulling the milk out, right, and creating the demand. Just going to the breast isn't a guarantee that milk is actually being emptied or taken from the breast. And so this is where I personally would want to like dig a lot deeper. I mean, traditionally, probably what would have happened in this situation is a wet nurse would have stepped in and helped feed the baby, right? Because we've definitely like always had supply issues in communities. And so this is where, you know, an auntie, a neighbor, someone else would come in and help support and feed the baby. And now we have that can certainly happen. We have donor milk and we have formula, which I totally recognize is an ideal food source. And so, but like as a lactation consultant, I would want to check out the baby. I would want to make sure that they're doing their part. Usually with supply issues, I say, almost all breastfeeding problems are a baby's fault. So there's very few things that a parent does wrong or right in a lot of ways to cause a breastfeeding problem. Usually it's on the baby side and something is happening on the baby side of things. And so, you know, I don't want to make assumptions around skill level or what you know, but I would definitely like dig deeper into, or want someone to dig a little deeper into the baby and see if there's something else that could be going on. Cause this can be hard, especially if we have a newborn that's not, and I don't think we know how old this baby is, it hasn't been gaining for weeks and still below birth weight. So normally we want babies back up to birth weight by 2 weeks. And so if baby hasn't been gaining and isn't there, then something is going on. And chances are we have a baby that is really lacking in nutrition, which is going to make them weaker and kind of they're not going to be in the best position to nurse well too. And so then that creates a really tough cycle to get out of, you know, this kind of catch 22 of we have a baby that wasn't getting enough milk. And so now they're not eating well, which then tells the mom's body not to make a bunch of milk. So it is a really hard cycle. So it says.
So I think that another thing that I want to just say is that I would, you know, just like we have to look at, you know, where is the baby? What is the nutrition? What is the family? Where is the mother? But that I think that it's true that there are more issues because I also think that more babies are experiencing trauma at birth. And yep. I think that more families are experiencing trauma. And maybe it's just that trauma was about separation. Maybe that trauma was about, you know, that their mother was struggling through their journey in ways that just we see in their first weeks and time together. And so I also feel really strongly, and I say this all the time, that, you know, yes, I've had the families that I've worked with that have had the tongue ties or had the, you know, different supply issues. I personally really, really struggled from a maternal side, and that I also
you know, feel really confident that the majority of people, when that baby, you know, was nourished, you know, it, from the womb through birth and into those arms, and it was just a continuation of that nourishment and that connection, that there are just so many fewer problems. There are so fewer problems. And that, so as far as comparing, you know, the tools that in how we can help mitigate this, I feel like we need to also remember that it's about food, it's about trauma, it's about connection, it's about bonding, and yes, that herbs help too, but that we need to be looking at that whole picture. And so, you know, it's one of those that I don't see nearly as much, you know, as in when there are uninterrupted beginnings. And so I have to just say that, you know, that it's just different. We're in different times in so many ways. And that, so some of those solutions are also going to be different if we have disrupted generations of caring for one another, that we also have to learn how to care for one another again in a lot of ways.
Yeah. Hi, I don't have a question. I just wanted to comment. My name is Angie. Hi, Kevin.
Hi.
I am a PhD student in health and medical geography, and I'm planning to do my research and dissertation on breastfeeding rates and access to support services in Indigenous communities. I basically just wanted to say thank you to everybody for all of this, because I get so wrapped up in academia all the time that I forget the purpose of why I'm doing this, which is all the stuff that you guys are talking about, getting back to ceremony, getting back to these original ways that were stolen from us through various, you know, methods. And so it's nice to be able to get back and hear about these, you know, birthing stories and the different ceremonies and everything that are involved with birth and breastfeeding, because like I said, it's just, I get so wrapped up in the sciencey stuff of research that I need gentle reminders of why I'm doing this, because I get frustrated on the academic side, because you know, what happens a lot of time is because we don't have a lot of research by Native people, and we don't have a lot of research on these particular topics, it gets dismissed, right? Because no researcher has come in and done research on this type of stuff, so it just gets dismissed as, oh, they're just telling stories. And so, anyway, my point is, I just want to say thank you to everybody for all your sharing and all the work that you do, because I fully plan to spend the rest of my days here on this earth supporting birth work and breastfeeding and everything that's involved there. So thank you, everybody, for everything that you do.
Rhonda, can I answer this question?
Yes, please.
From Shaylee, is that how I say her name? Shaylee Devlin?
Shaylee, yes. Yes, Shaylee is also currently pregnant.
Okay. So, Shaylee, I want you to know that you don't need to worry, because many women go into those other dimensions and they come back. Many people do. There's sometimes, though, when people that are helping with the birth are capable to, in situations where needed, to bring bring mama back, or to bring the parent back from a place they went to. So, oh my God, sorry, there's a rattler on my front porch. Okay, hold on a second, everybody. Oh my God, hold on. I gotta let him go. Let me see you. Can y'all see? You see him? Anyway, we're in Tucson.
I'm like,
you're. you're smiling about a rattler on your porch, and I don't think I would be doing the same thing. So.
Oh God, I'm just so glad he's going the other way. Okay, I got to keep an eye on him. I guess he was called in by the birth. So we understanding that it's that's why when we say birth, one of the reasons that Nana Thila, one of my teachers, said that birth is a ceremony is because the reality is, especially in times when women had a less nutritional good nutrition, there are times, you know, mama's birth, you know, and they didn't have all the access to nutrition. You are in that, you can be in that fine between the two doorways. Now that's not all the time, but it happens. And so that's why it's so important to be prepared. But when you go into those other dimensions, you come back usually, and it's not everyone that will go so far that we can't bring them back. And so I think it's not for you to worry about. It's for you to, as much as possible, just strengthen your life and to pay attention to your dreams and to have people around you, if possible, that have different kinds of abilities that can help you. And I think this is why it's important as we train people to bring back birth, that we can train our birth keepers to be able to respond to moments when they might arise. That's not, certainly not in every birth. Many births are not to that level. You go and you come back, and for some, they may struggle with that return, but it's certainly not the norm, you know? And so I want you that, even though we were talking about that, that's a possibility, that sometimes it's just a ceremony. You may need a couple to help you come back into your body. And for others, it could be that they need more ceremonies, a series of ceremonies, to make sure that they're integrated. And so, you know, remember that we have birthed for, you know, eons, and we're here, and that midwives were the keepers of those births up until recently, and it worked, and we're returning birth. And so I want you to feel really confident that from what we've talked about today, that you actually have that you'll be stronger, and rather than that something that we talked about might bring you some fear, just the possibility of what could happen in some cases. So, but you know, you should pay attention to your dreams and have people helping you, thinking about your dreams so that they can give a sense of how you're doing, what is being communicated to you from deep within your life and from deep from the universe. And that will be some preventative medicine for you. Make sure you're eating well. Make sure that you have lots of love around you as much as possible. And go outside whenever you can. Mother Earth to ground you. You know, drink, you know, water. Pray with your water, because your body is water, your womb is water. And make those prayers, you know, really confident that all of life is supporting you right now. And all of life will come together and will protect you at that moment. So every time you drink a glass of water, you say that prayer. You know, all of life is supporting me. All of life is protecting me. All of life will be there in the way that I need life to be.
So we have a couple of questions left, and we're also at time. And so what I would love to do is just, I think that processing birth stories and you know, healing, breastfeeding struggles and things like that are definitely going to be something that we'll need to do every time that we come together, because it's so profound. I've yet to meet someone who didn't have some aspect of their story where it was transformative and helped change them. And sometimes that can be really, really painful. And so I just want to say that I want to acknowledge that our time is ending, and also thank you for writing and your stories in the chat box, and that we will absolutely revisit them. Our next week episode, we will have two lovely, lovely families sharing. The idea came from seeing them just put out that question of, you know, to reclaim language, what was the first words that you wanted your baby to hear? And then I saw all these beautiful responses and all of these different indigenous languages of how people were greeting their babies and having that be the first sounds, you know, out of that were spoken. And then I also just seen sweet babies being fed traditional foods. And so we'll have two families that are gonna share about those first moments of their birth journeys and the first words and first foods, and also our beautiful Indigenous midwives. And so please join us again next week. And I will have this episode up on the website for anyone who came and went. And I thank you all so much. And Patricia, Cami, it's always lovely.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, everybody.